Welcome to Making Data Matter, where we have conversations about data and leadership at mission-driven organizations with practical insights into the intersection of nonprofit mission, strategy, and data. I'm your host, Sawyer Nyquist.
And I'm your co-host, Troy Duick.
And today we're joined by guest James Serra. James, welcome to the show.
Sure. Pleasure to be here.
And for folks just meeting you, James, could you share a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I am a technical specialist at Microsoft, focused on data and AI. I've been here a little over 9 years. I've been in the industry 40 years. I won't go back to my COBOL days and working on a VAX machine and getting into Visual Basic and using the first version of SQL Server in 89.
We might need to ask you what a VAX machine is, because I have no idea. So maybe we'll save that one for later. Yeah.
I'll give you a clue. It's a DEC VAX. Well, you probably never heard of DEC either. They were bought by Compaq. But yeah, you probably may not even know what COBOL is.
Only in history.
And I missed the punch card days.
So. Oh, COBOL? Crystal Reports? Come on. Everybody knows what that stuff
Crystal
is.
Crystal Reports. Yeah. Yeah. So I've been doing this a long time, about 40 years now, and I've been in various roles, developer, DBA, architect. And in the last 9 years at Microsoft, I focus on pre-sales, which is helping to educate customers. It's all about knowledge transfer. Customers may be looking to build a solution in Azure. They don't really know much about architecture or products. And so I'm there to help them along, choose the right architecture and the right products so they build something that's successful and is going to last a long time. A long time in a technical world, maybe 3 years, but at least that long.
Yeah. Now, and for our listeners' sake, this is a bit of a detour from our conversations where we've talked with people working at nonprofits. And the reason I chose to bring James on is because he's just written a book about data architectures, recently published a few months ago, early 2024, from O'Reilly, called Deciphering Data Architecture. And data architectures are relevant for all sorts of industries. They look different in different spaces, but I thought today would be a good space to have a conversation about data architectures, why, what, how, and everything between, and try to tie some of those knots and connecting over to the nonprofit world. So James, I want to start here. Can you tell me in the most basic way, like what's a data architecture? Give me maybe like some, explain to me like I'm five, what's a data architecture?
Maybe 6 years old.
Okay.
You have a few more words in your vocabulary. All right. And that's a very great and popular question. And I tried to explain it to some of my kids, my wife, and they're like, I don't still understand it. But the idea is, sometimes I work backwards. You're a company, you want to make better business decisions. Well, what can help you with that? Data. Okay. There's a lot of data that we have. How can we make better business decisions with that data? Well, you need to pull it all in and start analyzing with reports and dashboards and maybe throw in some machine learning. Well, okay, we can either pull it in. What else do we need to do? Maybe clean it and join it and aggregate it and do things to make it easy for anybody in your company to go and build reports off that. That whole process is data architecture. It's taking the data, ingesting it, storing it, transforming it, modeling it, and then visualizing it. And those are the five basic steps that you're going to need some type of architecture for. And there's many options of architecture, and I go through these in my book. But interestingly enough, over the last 30 years, we're still using some of the same architectures. Some the technology is, of course, involved, but the movement of data is still the same. You still got to clean it. You still got to transform it and join it and aggregate and do all these things to make it presentable. The technology makes it easier, but it still takes a long time to do all this. Somehow it takes even longer now. Well, wait a minute, the technology is better. Well, yeah, but in replace of that, we now are pulling in different types of data of size and the speed and the type. So before it was very straight. We have these relational databases. We need to pull that in and we'll do it once a night. Well, now it could be we need to do it multiple times a second. It could be data that's streaming in from IoT devices or social media data. It could be data that is huge. Back in my day, a huge amount of data was a megabyte. And now it's you know, petabytes of data in there. Well, how are you going to handle all that? And you can have data in all sorts of formats. It could be relational databases, CSV, JSON, Parquet files. and all that. So in the end, we're going to have a better solution because it's going to be incorporate all these types of data, but and make us help us make better business decisions. But it's going to have a more complicated data architecture. And so that is a long answer to a short question.
That was fantastic. My follow-up to that is, okay, now I'm maybe 25 years old, okay? I want to be a little bit older than six, but I have just been told, hey, here's the data for our entire company, and they send me an Excel file. Where do I go from there? You know, as a typical nonprofit person where we share mission critical data in files, in our inboxes, and I just want to know what's that next step to take without it feeling like you used a lot of big terms there for that six-year-old understanding of data architecture, but I'm just this lowly little guy trying to figure out how I can bring a little bit more data into the visibility for my leadership team at my medium-sized organization. What's that next step for building a good data architecture for my company?
Yeah, and in the book, I talk about the different stages of that you'll go through in building on a data architecture. And stage one is what you were explaining, which I call spread marts. Everybody's got spreadsheets sitting all over the place. And I've been involved with many projects that were trying to get from that point. And as you explained, I could have all these people have all these spread marts, spreadsheets everywhere, and they're sending them via email all over the place. And then somebody takes those and they combine it together and they got CSV files. And you look through the process and it could take hours, if not days, to generate one report, and it's usually not accurate. There's something missed. I've seen some, what's the right word? Excel macros, I lost that word, that were huge, that would run for an hours in there, and one little misstep and it would just go crazy on that. Customers would come to me and say, look, this is taking too long. It's inaccurate. It's not timely. What's the first step? And the first step is becoming aware of all those sources you're using it and copying those sources into a central location. Now, we can talk a lot about what that could be, but in the end, I need to have a single version of truth. So let me do the ingestion piece, find all those data sources, copy them to that central location, and then we take the next steps of transforming, cleaning, and doing all those things in there. But that's the first step, and that's part of that second stage. And there's five stages on there. The end result is I want to be able to use data no matter what the size, the speed, or the type. And that's a lot more work, but let's at least get started by finding those data sources. And that's where you start coming out with all these crazy things in there. And you have people that go, oh, I didn't realize they have some file that's sitting in their desktop. That's a key part of this. And if that desktop suddenly doesn't work, we're in a lot of trouble. So let's just copy it to a central location, and it's in the cloud. And therefore, it's got high availability, disaster recovery. Everybody knows where it is, and everybody can access it from any location. And we get rid of the problems of having this data that's in these secret compartments, and we centralize it and then start the next process, the next stage of doing more with the data. But that's always how to get started.
Some people's data security strategy is just to save Excel files on their own local computer so no one else can get to it, right? But that's what I see a lot is this like export to Excel and then save locally. And the flip of that is, hey, can we connect directly to those source systems and can we put it into a centralized place and remove that whole like export, save locally and have like inaccurate or stale copies of data floating around all over the place? There's a different, you also talk about another thing in the book that's like the stages of maturity that organization goes through. And I wrote them down here. It was reactive, informative, predictive, and transformative. And I'm curious if you could kind of speak to those, like, what does that look like if I'm trying to evaluate my organization and where we're at in terms of our maturity with data, reactive, informative, predictive, transformative. And then how does your data architecture change based on what stage you're in that kind of maturity cycle?
Yeah, and I was speaking to that earlier and now expanding on it when you give it to be predictive and transformative, not only involves building an architecture that can handle data with the size, speed, and type, but also doing more with the data. Instead of just trying to look at data and find historical trends, which is great, and it's a great starting point where I could take this data and then I can look at it and go, oh, now I understand why sales were low in this place. Or why we're out of inventory in this place. And I can use all these historical reports, see all these trends to make adjustments. Going the next step is doing predictive analytics on that data and creating machine learning models to then predict my sales. So don't just look at a historical trend and kind of get a gut feeling of what adjustments I should make. You can actually plug in some of the ideas you have and use machine learning models and predict whether the sales will go up or down. And then you can be proactive instead of reactive and say, well, as an typical example I use is I want to increase sales, my bike sales, and I have 10,000 customers in Seattle that I can market to. Do I really want to send out 10,000 mailings to everyone? Or more cost effectively, can I predict who would most likely buy a bike based on what them sending them something? Who are the people that are bike riders and are actively looking for bikes and are close to the shop? And then focus my attention on maybe 100 people instead of 10,000 people on that. So that's one thing you can do with predictive analytics, among many other things in there. The challenge, and this is where sometimes I get people too excited. They look at the dashboards and reports that you can create and the machine learning models and like, oh my God, this is perfect. This is what we need. It's going to save me time, make better business decisions. I'm going to look good to my boss. I'm going to increase the revenue and all this. Let's do this. Okay. But now comes the difficult part of getting all that data in there and not only using it now for reports and dashboards, but to train machine learning models. And those are only as accurate as the data you gather for it. So then you start talking about you have to pull in much more data in order to train those models to be more accurate.
Yeah. And as you talk about the bike illustration, the natural one in the nonprofit world is usually like, hey, I've got a large list of potential donors. Who are the people that are going to be most interested in like donating to our organization? Or who are the people who are going to be the best fit for our programs that we're offering, our services and things like that? How do we market to them specifically and not waste thousands or millions of dollars trying to spread an extremely wide net?
Yeah, and I'll add to that. If you get data on all your donors and how much they've donated over the months and years, you can use that to predict which of those donors may stop donating based on certain trends. Like maybe typically what you'll see is people start donating less and less over more expanded periods of times. And a machine learning model will go, there's an 80% chance this person is going to stop donating. So can we do something proactive to prevent that? Even if it's just a thank you card or something to them to keep it going. Well, I don't want to send thank you cards to a million people. Can I narrow it down? And that's what machine learning can do for you.
Now, the next question is, how do you confront the expectation shock that hits a lot of these people when you tell them how long it's going to take to build some of these machine learning models? We live in that microwave society where everyone's like, oh, can't you just get this standing up in a couple days and I can start seeing this on my data and start doing predictive analytics? What is that look like to, or a strategy that you've used to set expectations where, you know, it's going to take a little bit longer than 1 week to get you to that predictive or transformative stage of data maturity?
Yeah, and run into that in some occasions where we do a POC and we show a C-level person, oh, look, this is what we can do. And he's like, oh, it's already done. I go, no, this is the POC. Well, how hard can it be? Just use the real data then. and then you have to explain to him. But I try to do that up front. Usually I start out with, again, I'm plugging my book, but an architect design session is the first step. And you set expectations in there. You come up with a high-level architecture, but I always hit on the point, this is going to take a long time to do. Yeah, the technology is better, but there's no magic button. This whole process is going to not only take a long time, but it's never going to end because you're going to start giving them reports and dashboards they never had before. And they're going to go like, oh my God, this is awesome. Can you add this data to it? Can you add this data source to it in there? So you have to set those expectations in there. And then you say things like, well, we want to make sure those first reports are high quality and don't have errors. So we need to spend a lot of time cleaning the data, mastering the data. And I always say, as much as you think the data is clean, I guarantee you, you're going to find problems in there. And I always bet, I'll bet you $100, and I always win that bet because you get pull data in there and you go like, look at these birth dates. Why are the birth dates in the future or why are they null? Well, your entry system required a birth date. They didn't know it. So they just put anything in there to get it to go to the next step. And so that all comes out there. And then mastering, they don't think, like, what do you mean mastering? Well, I'm pulling data from all these sources. All these sources could have the customer in there, and there could be duplicates. They may be the same customer. We got to make sure we're not creating a report that has the same customer listed multiple times when it's really the same person. That requires mastering the data. Oh, I never really thought about that. Isn't that easy to do? No, because now the names could be misspelled, or they could have junior on there, or they could have moved addresses. And you have to have some kind of technology that's going to figure all that and create the golden record. So you start explaining all that and make sure they have enough time up front for cleaning the data. And when you get the whole data governance thing is, we have to have this secure. So now we got to put a lot of time in our project plan to make sure that you're not on the front page of the Wall Street Journal because somebody breached it. So here's what the things you got to do to clean it, to secure it. And it's just an education process. And most times when you do that, they're like, oh, okay, I understand this is going to take a while. I expect it now. And then they don't become disheartened when things take a long time or somebody runs into some problems because, oh, I remember James mentioned this could happen. So now we're expecting it. And so it's not a big deal.
Yeah, man, setting expectations up front just changes the game so much. We recently built a house, and there were numerous times in the process when they gave us an expectation of a timeline that wasn't met, and we were very disappointed. For instance, like the framers came through to frame the house, and they're like, oh, it'll be about a week and a half to frame the house. This crew is really fast. And like 3 weeks later, things weren't framed yet. And so we're like, when are we going to be done here? And so setting an expectation and actually matching that expectation, either it's high or low, but aligning that just has a big job of easing people's understanding and their anxiety and their excitement and tempering some of those emotions along the way. You mentioned in the book, as I looked through it, talking about self-service analytics or self-service business intelligence. And I think, I don't remember the exact terminology, I didn't pull the quote right now, but I remember it being something to the effect of like, that's the gold standard or the goal of a data architecture is self-service. And I'm curious if you could describe a bit more, like, what do you mean by self-service analytics or self-service business intelligence? And why is that so desirable?
Yeah, I call that self-service BI, business intelligence, in the book. The term's been around a while, it's a little dated, but self-service is the main part of it. The whole idea is I want to build a solution that anybody being end users who could be not technical at all, build reports and dashboards and get value out of the data and make business decisions without having to get IT involved. I can't tell you how many times when I was a DBA and developer that I had end users coming to me and say, I need you to create this report because it's too complicated. I don't understand all this data it's weird naming conventions. It's all these views, which I don't get, views calling views. And I just want to create a report and I can't figure this all out on that. And then now IT becomes a bottleneck because suddenly we're asked to create all those reports and people in IT do not like creating reports. And so I would say, sure, I'll get back to you. It could be a week, 2 weeks, could be months on that. So instead, you want to spend more time building the solution if the payoff will be self-service BI. Is can IT do enough on those five steps, clean and transform and make the data presentable so they're not involved? So in the end, you say, you want a report? Look, you go into, say, Power BI, and here's a semantic model that's all set up for you. So just start dragging the fields on there and creating reports and dashboards on there. Especially I saw a lot of times there'd be some person in your company that was the only one who understood how all this data should be grouped together, and he would know the terminology and how to create views to do all that. And if that person wasn't around, then you're in a lot of trouble on that. So let's get rid of that problem by doing all this stuff. And it actually comes down to a lot of things I talk about. Why have a data warehouse in there? And some of those are renaming the tables and fields from the source system to be more understandable, joining the data to make it easier for people to use and doing all those things. So they just have that workspace and they just drag those fields over on that. That's the true self-service BI. Get IT out of the business of report writing, and even creating models could be done by the end users. They may need to have a little more technology, the understanding of what does it mean to join data together, but they could then create the models and not IT. And then those models created could then serve hundreds or thousands of other people building those reports on their own.
So as you're talking about self-service BI, it makes me wonder about data mesh and how does the concepts of centralizing data in a central location actually work complementary with data mesh, where you start to then federate that out to the business units? And I know you have a whole section in your book on data mesh, so I'm just wondering if you could share more with the audience what it looks like. What are some of the trade-offs as you're centralizing data, you have a centralized IT working on something, versus data mesh, where you start to federate it out to the business units, you embed your technical folks in those areas, and you have these business domains that may or may not be able to cross data within that data mesh. So what does that look like? And think about it even from the nonprofit angle of how can lean teams implement something like that? Is that a recommendation you'd even give?
Yeah, sure. Data architectures I've come in referencing so far have been centralizing the data, copying it into one location. Now, when you do that, in most cases, IT becomes ownership of that data. It's copied into a central storage that IT owns. So now IT is going to clean the data, and then IT is going, and you're using IT's organizational people, you're using IT's infrastructure. And then they take that data, which starts out just as a copy of operational data. And then IT then starts cleaning it, transforming it, doing all those things to make it analytical data, data used for reporting on there. And so IT does all that work, and it's all centralized. So that resulting data, that's analytical data, it could be in third star schema, third normal form, but its specific purpose is for reporting and dashboarding machine learning models. Very different than the operational data. Now, that has been the way that's going on forever. However, the data mesh came around, and I have to say it's actually not a new concept. There have been versions of this before. It's just wrapped up really nicely now in decentralizing it. And so basic idea is, instead of having all these groups within your company who have operational data copying it to IT, IT goes, we're not going to take that data anymore. We want each of the organizations within there, it could be HR, finance, but they're organized into domains, so we'll call them domains, are now tasked with taking their operational data and creating the analytical data. So each domain has to have their own mini IT team, has to have their own infrastructure to create the analytical data. And the benefits of that are they know the data best, so they know how to clean it better than IT would, at least in theory. They're going to maintain ownership of the data, and then they're going to make data as a product, making it easy for anybody else outside of their domain, other domains, or some person who needs to consume the data. They're going to make it easy for them to access that data. So they do all the work. So you're federating out the problem done over many domains, and therefore you get the benefit of two main benefits of data mesh: organizational and technical scaling. Each of those domains now are going to hire their own people. So the more domains you have, the more people that are hired. You're scaling out organizationally. So IT doesn't become a bottleneck with people, because the more domain you ingest, IT is limited on what they can handle. They start getting overwhelmed, and they become a backlog on there, and that bottleneck in there, that goes away. And then the other problem is that goes away is technical scaling. If everybody's copying into central location, you're bound on this, the technology that IT is using to handle all that data. And the more data comes in, the more they might run into a problem like, oh, our performance is suffering, or we're running out of disk space. All these things that have, a lot of them have gone away with technology, but they're still there as a problem. Each domain has their own infrastructure. More domains, more infrastructure. Now you have the technical scaling. Now, the confusion with data mesh is that's decentralized. That's federating out all the data, but not everything is decentralized in a data mesh. There's four principles. I kind of explained the first two. The next two come in to play with, we can't have each domain just creating everything from scratch. They'll take forever. So let's create ideally some scripts that each domain can use to build out their infrastructure, to create the ETL and the governance and the storage. And so there's a central team that creates these scripts. Now that could be made up of individuals from each of the domains, but it's still a central team that says, here you go, domain, use these scripts to jumpstart building out your solution, your analytical data. And also we need a central team that is going to help with creating standards from everyone, creating global rules for all the domains. We can't have one domain using completely different security than another, because many times we need to combine the data, and that's going to be extremely challenging. We either need to set standards on how to clean data. We can't have somebody saying, well, for states in the US, we'll use two letters and somebody else using the full state name. That means it's going to be really challenging to combine all that data. So you have a central team that creates all these standards that goes to each domain and says, follow these standards. And there. Now, we're not going to do the work. You do the work, and maybe we'll monitor it to make sure everybody's doing it. But the end result is you have to think about all this data and domains eventually going to be combined. So we need to make it easier for all those rules to make that process easier.
Boy, that sounds hard.
So data mesh, and I'm going to say from the beginning, it is very difficult to build data mesh. It'll take you a lot longer to implement that solution than the other ones I've talked about. At best case, maybe 1% of the companies in the whole world will be able to use a data mesh. I will say in its purest form, but nobody's going to build a data mesh in a purest form. I won't go into that. But in the end, and this is a good spot to say this, is we can talk about all these architectures. In the end, read about all the architectures and then pick out the best pieces that are going to work for your specific use case. There's going to be exceptions. Tons of exceptions. You may look at the data mesh and go, that's not for us, but I do like the idea of data as a product. So I'm going to use one of the other architectures, but I'm going to treat data as a product because I like that aspect of a data mesh. So I'm not going to go full data mesh. I'm just going to use a piece of it. And that's what I see customers doing. Almost every architecture that I draw out for customers is different because it's all going to be depending on their size, speed, and type of the data in there. And there's going to be exceptions, and especially when you get into nonprofits and they need to have cost savings in there, that can lead to a big difference in the data architectures. Also, the amount of data. If you have a very small amount of data, that can completely change the architecture. You can skip steps in there. You can use what I would say would be non-traditional solutions now.
You can cheat.
Unless you have a small amount of data. You can cheat. As long as you understand that this is going to limit future growth. And if you say, well, we don't have much data, we only have 500 gigs now, okay, we can build a solution. But if you start adding to that, then you're going to be like, oh, we can't handle streaming data. We can't handle JSON format. We can't handle data that's over a terabyte in there. You're going to lock yourself in. So you have to be really certain you're never going to grow that much, which happens on there. But go through and think through not only the data sources you have now, but what you're going to have in the next 6 months or a year or two.
That's all great advice. And that's exactly what I think I was after in terms of what does it look like to evaluate some of these things that get all the attention out there in the data space, like, ooh, data mesh, it's the cool, shiny new thing. Or we haven't even talked about data fabric yet. And, you know, wait, isn't that Microsoft's thing? You know, like that's the big question. But yeah, your advice really is sound. You have to evaluate the size of your data, the size of your org, the technical skills of your team, how many team members you have that you can invest in building these architectures. So these are all great considerations. And I love your advice of saying, read about all of them, learn about all of them, and then pick and choose what's going to best fit your context and what you're really dealing with. And I think that's where the paralysis can happen sometimes in these teams, these lean, nonprofit, cost savings focused teams, is there's too many options. They don't know where to start and what the right thing to consider. What's the biggest consideration as we're looking at this? So as I frame even that last question, I'm thinking about any thoughts as you're just thinking about if there's one thing you want to focus on as a lean team when it comes to data architecture, how might you answer that question?
This is sometimes a plug for me or Sawyer, is get an expert who can help you with this. It's going to be well worth it. Even if you are on a shoestring budget, if you spend some time up front with an expert to design the architecture to make you aware of all the products that are available and narrow it down to what's going to fit your use case, there's a lot of tools in the toolbox. The mistake I've seen why projects fail is people use the hammer for everything and they don't know about these other products. So educate yourself, usually through having time with somebody who's gone through all this process, who knows, who spends half their day at least learning and keeping up with all the technology so they can have you go down the right path. So you're not 6 months into it and go like, oh my God, why did we choose this? It's not handling the data we had. Why did, and I can come in and say, why didn't you use this product? Well, we didn't even know that existed. And well, that's where you should have spent even a day or two with somebody up front that could have listened to your use case and come up with some ideas and options for you. And at least get you started into, you don't know what you don't know. So even if they say, well, you don't have to use me for everything, but I'm going to narrow it down. So now you can go and learn about those products. And then maybe you come back with questions in there. But the biggest mistake you can have is we can do this on our own. And then you go and you choose all the wrong technologies. And I've seen customers spend tens of millions of dollars. And 2 years down the road, they build something that is completely unusable and have to start from scratch again.
Yep. I'll go down into one real specific example that, you know, feel free to speak into this one. But currently, I'm working at a company where we've built everything on the Azure stack. Most of it is Azure SQL databases. And all of a sudden, Microsoft Fabric is, you know, generally available. And the big question is, should we move? Should we migrate over? And that's been a challenging question for the team because it's like, well, we've built some custom solutions. We have some scripts that we've written over here that don't seem to translate directly over into the Fabric environment, but there's something really exciting about Fabric and what it could offer as an integrated platform, giving us a little more access to things for citizen development. And so we're struggling right now. How do we evaluate that? So I think you're saying getting those experts there with your team to sit with you in those questions and help you evaluate, okay, is there value in that, is a critical point. So I don't know if I have a question as much as a comment that, you know, I'm living that right now, is how do you evaluate that? And getting an outside perspective can be way worth the cost, just to be able to sit with someone who sees it from a different vantage point than the people who can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah, especially cutting through the hype of some of these. And I'm usually upfront with customers and honest with them. And I may say, you know, I don't think migrating is really the thing to do for you, at least not now. And I can go over all the steps it's going to take to get there. And you can judge whether it's worthwhile, but it may not be on that. Now we can talk about what it would take for you to eventually get there and then work involved and tools that may be available to help with that. But there's some cases where I've told customers, yeah, you should wait on this. I don't think it's worthwhile in there. And also, if you get the right person who has, we'll call it inside knowledge of what Microsoft is doing, that could be a great help too. Because when I have architect design sessions, I will quite often tell customers what's coming down the road, because you're going to go build a solution that's going to probably take 6 months to a year to even get some value out of it. I don't want you to be 6 months in there and a new product comes out of Microsoft and you go like, why didn't you tell me about this, James? So I have to keep up on what Microsoft's working with. Microsoft Fabric is a great example of that. I knew about it a year and a half before it was announced. So for the right customer, I would say, you know, there's something I should tell you about that's coming out that I think you can use. So there's that part of it. And it may not be a whole new product. It may just be new features. Like in Fabric, there's going to be migration tools coming out that they haven't really announced yet. And you may want to know about them to say, well, should I migrate now or should I wait until this new tool comes out there? And then we can talk about that. So everybody's different in use case. And I'm the first one to say, just don't jump on something because it's a shiny new toy, whether it be a product or something like data mesh. Let's build a data mesh. Everybody's talking about it there. And then the book came about when I started researching Data Fabric. And I go, well, I don't know about this. We went through this process before with centralization and decentralization. And people as old as me will remember the Kimball days and Inman days when we talked about with Kimball, and it was the idea of creating data marts and decentralizing. And the data marts were local to each department. And the whole thing logically was a data warehouse, but the data marts were all done by individual domain teams. We didn't call them domain teams at the time. And I was like, well, now we're talking about that again. So then I think back, well, what was the problems? Why didn't that become really popular? And it was because of the problems we found with decentralization. And frequently it was, well, it costs a lot more because now you're hiring each of your teams and then they're all kind of redoing the same thing. But they all have their own teams, their own infrastructure. And what I saw happen back then was some new CEO would come in there and go, well, wait a minute, why are all these departments building their own solutions. Why are they using their infrastructure in teams? Let's save costs. Let's create one team with one infrastructure and then get rid of all these teams and all this extra hardware and that. And then you saw people going back to centralization. Now we're going back to decentralization. And the same thing is going to come up. You're going to see all these domains spending all this money, creating their own teams and their own infrastructure. And somebody's going to come out and say, that's not cost effective. Right. Facebook.
I love these, like, looking at decades arc of your experience across the data landscape, because history does repeat itself. It's like, hey, we've seen this trend before 20 years ago. And so in this conversation too, we touched on like the newest and the shiniest new tools like Microsoft Fabric. I'm curious, but a lot of people I talk with still like have on-prem servers and are running databases on-prem, and which feels like a legacy technology. I'm curious, James, what are some arguments for like, or good reasons to still keep your on-prem technology? I think a lot of organizations are kind of facing that. Like, do we go to the cloud? Should we stay on-prem? Have we invested in our on-prem technology? What are reasons you should just like keep your on-prem tech or continue to invest in your on-prem tech as opposed to moving to the cloud?
Yeah, and that's a common question I got, and why I included a chapter in the book a lot on when to move to the cloud, the benefits of the cloud, and when to stay on-prem, which is very rare now, even especially for larger companies on there, where they're pretty much all in the cloud, at least partially in there, but completely understand they're medium and small companies that if you're new, don't go do anything on-prem, do everything in the cloud. But if you have existing data centers in there, there are a handful of reasons that you may have one. Maybe you've invested this money in data center and you have a long lease in there. Maybe you've just upgraded all your hardware. Maybe you have performance issues with things going to the cloud, and even millisecond response time could add up into too long of delays for something, some machine that needs to make split second decisions and needs to have the database right there on that. Or you don't have an internet connection. I'm down in a cave somewhere and I don't have an internet in there. Outside of that, there isn't very many reasons to have something on-prem. I see people say, well, cost can be too much in the cloud, but they're not thinking through the indirect costs that you're going to have on-prem on there. Things like, well, what is the cost of waking somebody up 2 o'clock in the morning to go fix the hardware that is automatically handled within the cloud in there? What are the costs of high availability and doing those things, not just in the technology, but the manpower to keep it going on there? And then you'll ask, like, well, what about disaster recovery on-prem? And like, well, we don't have that. Why not? Well, it's too expensive. In the cloud, you press a few buttons, you have a disaster recovery. How much is that worth to it? So all these indirect costs come into play. And then when you put all that and try to guess that on paper, you're like, oh, it could actually be a lot more doing things on-prem. Things like technology advancements. It could take many months, if not years, to upgrade hardware on-prem. I can click a button and in like 10 seconds, I have new hardware on that. Or any new features and products that come out are going to come out on the cloud and eventually, at best, become on-prem in there, but they may never come or it may take too long. Why didn't take advantage of that stuff now to make better business decisions quicker? So all these things come into play. So I'm very hesitant to recommend anybody do anything on-prem or stay on-prem. At least have a long-term goal to start migrating things off. Maybe let's for new things we'll do in the cloud or test environments or dev environments we'll do in the cloud. And then you can see all the benefits. The hardest part is dealing with people don't like change. So you're dealing with people who, I like everything the way it is. We called some people the server huggers because they didn't feel like it was secure unless they can go and hug it, thinking that on-prem data is more secure in the cloud. When I go, no, let me talk to you about all the security you have in the cloud. And it's way more than you have on-prem. And it takes a lot of convincing sometimes when you go through it all and they're like, wow, I didn't realize you had all this stuff, the level of security inside the cloud in there. So it's just educating people.
And a lot of the cost issues that I see in the cloud are because you picked the wrong product or it's designed poorly, and that the cloud can be really cost effective and really efficient. But when people end up with massive cloud bills, it's because, oh, you left something running, or because you designed this really poorly, or you're just on the wrong product and that product's really expensive and there's a much cheaper option. So on-prem probably can be cheaper if you're really sharp and really know what you're doing, but the cloud, well designed and well chosen, is very cost effective with how the technology has advanced.
And Microsoft's come a long way where we have a lot of recommendations now that will tell you, look, you have this provision at a high tier and nobody's using it. So you should just lower it on that. Click this button and it'll automatically lower it. So they've done a lot of things that people have found, like, look at all the money we've saved by going to the cloud, because it's analyzing, it's using machine learning and large language models to go and help us with those cost decisions in there. And then it's learning about things in the cloud, like storage. There's hot, cool, cold, and archive. And there's things you can do to save costs on storage on there. Or things like failing fast. If I go to build a solution on-prem and I get all this hardware and I install it and rack it and configure it, and then I start working on a solution and like, oh, this isn't going to work, let's cancel this project. Now I got all this extra hardware. In the cloud, you just click a button and all that stuff's gone. So you can be more adventurous and take more risks, because you could do something in the cloud and see if it's beneficial. And if it turns out not to be, you just wipe it all away and your costs are immediately gone.
You started to dip into this for a second. As we've talked about the history of where things have been and then now looking forward about where things are going, you mentioned generative AI and even just like technology progression in the cloud. I'm curious how you see generative AI, and I know you've been writing about this and talking about this with people, how that connects to data architecture and kind of this world of databases and data warehouses and analytics that we've been talking about. Where do you see generative AI kind of connecting to there, and how should people think about that?
Yeah. I've had a couple blogs on this. I got more to go. Talk about how you can blend decision-making with data meaning numbers, and text. Large language models are all about text right now. And can I look at all these documents and come up with better business decisions just by using those large language models to come up with answers? But everything that's fed into large language models is text. Now that's starting to change, and you're starting to see some data being ingested and then asking questions of it. But that's still a very small part of large language models. Now I think they converge over the next couple of years. And the idea is, can I take what's traditionally been creating dashboards and reports and machine learning, the traditional predictive analytics, and then join that or combine that with text data and use the large language models on that text data and some of that data? So as an example could be, I want to help create reports on that have with it, maybe I'm a manufacturer of refrigerators and I want to create reports that show me my sales, but I also want to link that up with maybe customer reviews, and I want to summarize those reviews, and I could use a large language model that's going to do that and attach it to that data. Maybe I want to take all the user guides and summarize all that and make it available for people to ask questions with not only all that information about the refrigerators, the text information, but also now I can take data and combine those two to give that person, whether it's somebody internal to that company to help with a technical issue or to explain a product, or somebody from the outside to get information that they're requesting or to solve problems on their own on that. So we're going to see a blending of the two right now. But right now, large language models is just touching on how to use data. And I don't think it's ever, can you teach the models so well that you can just say, here's my database, create a report for me that's going to show all my sales. And right now it's mainly a combination of using a traditional product like a Power BI with Copilot, machine learning models, large language models within it to help me build the report, to help me add additional explanations of the report within it. And so that's where it's going. And that's where we have some of that now. And I think for the foreseeable future, it'll be a combination of the two. We're not going to just say we don't need Power BI anymore because the large language model is going to answer everything. It'll be a combination of both.
Yeah. That combining of the text world and all those documents and images and video and like that language world with our like database world that we've been so familiar with. And there's so many opportunities for like blending, connecting those two spaces together to really operationalize all of the information. I've always thought about data for a long time as like data is rows and columns, and like, oh, data is information, and information is stored in so many other parts of our organizations with these text documents and with these manuals and videos and user reviews and all those types of things. If you can blend in like all the information that's actually embedded in your organization from not just your database, but everything else that lives on SharePoint or on people's desktops, those documents, that's huge. And that's a great opportunity ahead. Well, James, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us. And for people who want to find out more about you or reach out online or pick up a copy of your book, where can they go to find you online, James?
Any of the major networks, NBC, CBS, we cover. I'm not Stephen King or James Patterson. You can go to my blog site, jamesserra.com. And in there, you can read blogs. I've been doing it for 13 years. You'll find a lot of helpful stuff there. That's all free. There's a link there to my book where you go to Amazon and type in Deciphering Data Architectures and order the book, whether it's you like me, like a printed or a Kindle version of there. And feel free to ask me questions if you have them outside of what you get from my blog. My email address is on the site. It's jamesserra3@gmail.com. I love talking about this stuff. I love helping people out. That's what I do in my job. So I'm happy to field any questions for you. And then a lot of my blogs have links to other sites that could have a lot of great information in there. Really, the book was just a combination of all that and doing a brain dump and making it easier to understand and packaging it together well. So you can go and you don't have to read it from beginning to end. You can pick spots that you're most interested in there. But I wanted to get all that information out of my head into a book so people can get started very quickly and understand that even if they're not a data engineer, it's designed for the C-level person who maybe understands a little bit of data, but wants to know more. And this book is a good starting point.
And I'll just add my plug to the book. I mean, we've barely dipped our toe into the topics that you cover there. And I would just recommend it to our audience that there's a lot of really great stuff. And even if you don't think you're involved in data architecture in your role, whether that's as an analyst or a data engineer or someone at the C-suite level, I find this just to be a helpful book to think about data at a very high level. So don't let the word architecture scare you away from grabbing this book, digging into these topics. There's definitely a lot more covered there. So a shameless plug for James' excellent material there.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I don't talk about products in the book, so it's not a Microsoft book. I wanted something that could last many years. Even the Kimball and Inman books, which I have some back there, they're 20, 30 years old and are still relevant. There's still these concepts I've been around a long time, and I try to explain them in hopefully an easy to understand term. But a lot of the stuff has been around for a long time. It's just packaged together there. And I didn't want a book that I was going to publish and be out of date because the technology changes so quickly in there. So I'm hoping this book can be around for 10, 20, 30 years. I mean, 20 years from now, we may be going data mesh. Remember that thing? Oh, that was nuts. And that. But the concepts in there, like I said, are not new, and they just may be called something differently or packaged differently. But there's a lot of things in the book that have been around quite a long time on there. And it's just helpful. I always say my brain's kind of slow. It takes me a long time to understand something. So I'm going to write things for people like with my brain. And I find out a lot of people are like, yeah, I didn't get that right away. Thanks for explaining it and taking a complex subject and making it easy to understand. And I did that for me to start off with, and then I put it in the book. And so it really helps those people that don't have a lot of technical background.
That's why I enjoyed it so much. I have a slow brain, I guess. Okay. So data architecture for slow brains. I like that.
I think we all have slow brains. Yeah. Especially at Microsoft, you think everybody's super smart and picks up this stuff really quickly, but you find like, no, that's not the case. Some people were just afraid to ask questions, and I'm always the first one asking questions, and people are like, oh, thank you. Glad you. I never understood it because I didn't want to appear dumb. So, and I said that's just going to hurt you from learning quicker in there. And I even a lot of people in Microsoft going, oh, this book's great. I didn't understand the stuff, or I thought I did, and it turns out I didn't. Or you brought up topics and concepts I never even knew about, and so it does a great help to accelerate people's learning curve.
Well. Speaking of books, I have to get a dad joke in here. It's just my calling card. And so I got to ask, James, if you were to throw all the books in the ocean, what would you get?
I don't know. Tell me.
A tidal wave.
A tidal. Yes, yes. And James lives right by the ocean, so this is very appropriate. Good choice, Troy. Tidal wave. All right. Well, this has been great. Folks, that's all for today on Making Data Matter. We'll hope you'll join us again next time. Goodbye, everybody.